From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai today. Barack Obama spends the week meeting with key Middle Eastern leaders, has this international tour given him commander-in-chief credibility? And is John McCain about to announce his pick for vice president, or is he dangling that carrot to keep his name in the headlines while Obama is getting all the ink? Here to give us their perspectives on the campaign news of the day, we have Democratic strategist Donna Brazil. She is an author and a nationally syndicated columnist. And Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. Ron is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hello, both of you.
Hello, Tony.
Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you back again. Today, Barack Obama has been meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, as we know. Earlier in the week, he met with Iraqi leaders and U.S. military officials. A great deal has been said about the trip, his positions, whether they've changed, and what impact this made for the campaign event is having on voters. So, Ron, let me start with you. Give him a grade so far on all of the above.
Well, Tony, I think I'd give him two grades. I'd give him a grade on substance, and I'd give him a grade on overall qualities to be commander-in-chief. On substance on the trip, I think I'd give him a C. He has looked very good, no question about that, talking with world leaders over in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Israel. But the question remains whether or not he has the experience and he has the temperament to be commander-in-chief. And on that, I'd give him an incomplete. Just because one goes over and has a series of meetings with world leaders does not suddenly make them filled with substance and stature that qualifies them to be the commander-in-chief. I'm very concerned about Senator Obama's inconsistent statements regarding the troop withdrawals in Iraq. He refuses to say that the surge that the commander-in-chief George W. Bush and General David Petraeus put in place that has reduced violence dramatically in the region. And finally, Senator Obama, I believe, is trying to score political points when he's with our troops, and the most important thing that we need to do is to continue to find a way to wage and win a war on terrorism rather than using our troops as a photo op and a backdrop for his political ambitions.
Let's follow up on that point, Donna Brazil, because I'd like to ask you two things. First, does it hurt Obama's credibility to go on with a plan that is not in line precisely with General Petraeus' direct recommendations, bearing in mind, of course, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, said just yesterday in a PBS interview that some of what Obama is saying with regard to the need for troops elsewhere, specifically Afghanistan, was true, and that they had to come from someplace, presumably a drawdown in Iraq. And he even went on to say that, or he intimated that, a drawdown could begin this fall, depending on what happens on the ground. So does that mean that everyone is becoming closer together?
Well, yes, there's a consensus that's now being formed, not only by Senator Obama, who's shown great leadership and great temperament throughout his travels abroad, but there's also a consensus being developed here. I mean, President Bush is now calling for a time horizon. He's recognizing not only the success of the surge, and let me just say, as a Democrat, we have the best military force in the world. And the fact that our troops are performing well under very difficult circumstances is a testament to not only their training, but also their desire and commitment to finish the job. I think what Senator Obama has tried to do on this week-long trip across the globe is to, one, listen to leaders in the region to get an assessment, with the conditions not only in the Middle East, but also to hear from our European allies on what they would like to see happen. And this is not just about the surge. We're now in a post-surge Iraq. What's the plan? The Bush administration and John McCain, who seems to echo everything that comes out of the president's mouth, do not have a plan, a post-surge plan, to ensure that not only is the Iraqi forces prepared to take over, as they have done now in the southern part of Iraq where the British has left, but more importantly, what's the future? They have elections scheduled later this year. The Iraqi leaders, including the Sunnis, would like to see the American forces out. It may not be a date certain, but it's a time period because they're ready to step up and lead their own sovereign nation.
One of the things that has happened with regard to this trip, we have moved from Iraq into Israel, where Obama held a news conference just today, Ron. He answered the questions. My question to you is, did he seem less confident about his answers this morning than he does when he's discussing the war or the economy, let's say?
Well, Tony, I think he does. I think he has continued to evolve in his knowledge of foreign policy matters. He's been in the Senate, I think, for 163 legislative days. He's now the chairman of the subcommittee on the Foreign Relations Committee that deals specifically with Afghanistan, but yet this was the first time that he was in Afghanistan. He's shown more of an aptitude with that part of the world, but I think he continues to struggle and grapple with how to deal with Jerusalem. Should it be a divided capital? Should it be a united capital? How to deal with the existence of those in the region who do not want the Jewish state to exist, who want to eliminate the Jewish state as it currently exists? How does one negotiate from a position of strength with those who are trying to diminish, if not destroy, one of America's strongest allies in the region? So looking at his press conference and some of the coverage I've seen earlier today, I do not think he sounds as confident as he does on other issues. But again, his confidence is almost unnerving for someone who has such a lack of foreign policy experience to purport to demonstrate such a substantive knowledge.
You know, Ron, what's so interesting in all of your analysis about Senator Obama's perceived inexperience is the so-called experience and judgment that has put America in such a weakened state militarily, put America in such a weakened state economically. You know, the talking points that the Republicans are using about Senator Obama are just flat out old recycled material. Senator Obama has shown not just that he's comfortable talking about these issues, meeting with Israeli leaders, but he's also thoughtful and engaging in listening to Mr. Benjamin
Netanyahu.
Yes, he's meeting with the defense minister. The purpose of the trip is to gain insights and information from those on the ground, to talk about the economy over there, to talk about the crisis, to talk about Iran. And I saw the same press conference where he appeared very confident about what not only he's learning, but also, again, making a serious commitment to strengthening U.S.-Israeli ties, supporting Israel. He has been a firm supporter of Israel. So I don't think there's any discomfort. I think what Senator Obama's goals this week was to go and meet these leaders and to learn and listen, unlike some of people we know that may travel overseas but don't listen to anyone.
Well, let's use this opportunity to move to the third part of our discussion in the time that we have left, because it's important, and it has to do with, you talked about purpose, Donna Brazile, and the purpose of the trip for Barack Obama. The purpose this week for John McCain might be described quite differently. News was brewing that he might announce his vice presidential candidate this week in an effort to minimize the media frenzy that has been circling Barack Obama on his trip overseas. He's made no such announcement and yesterday said, quote, "We will announce when we are ready to announce." My question to you, Ron, is does this sound like McCain has already made up his mind on a running mate but just isn't saying so? What's he doing?
I'm sure he has. I'm sure he has settled to one or two people who he thinks could best help him lead the country. I think Senator McCain's problem right now is he's trying to find a way to be relevant. He's not had a very good series of weeks and a good series of events in the last couple days and weeks. And I think Senator McCain is trying to find a way to remain relevant and to stay in the news. Senator Obama, there's no question, has been the force that has sucked all the oxygen out of the room. And Senator McCain is trying to find a way to make himself visible to the American people so that his message still counts. The last thing I'd say, Tony, to my dear friend Donna Brazile, the question as it relates to Senator Obama is, it's a very earnest question that I think the American people deserve an answer to. He is very thoughtful. He is very charismatic. He is very telegenic. But it's a question of experience. And just because someone has been in the Senate for only a handful of years does not suddenly make him experienced, Donna. But I don't take anything away from his thoughtfulness or his ability to connect with people. So, again, Senator McCain is fighting an uphill battle,
Tony. Well, he's had more experience in government, be it state and federal government, than the president who is now serving this country.
No, he hasn't. You can't point to one specific measure he signed into law.
He can't name one accomplishment, Donna,
that he has in the Senate.
Who backed the Earned Income Tax Credit in Illinois. And in the United States Senate, he has been a leader working with Mr. Lugar on ending nuclear proliferation. He took the lead in the Congressional Ethics Reform and Congressional Lobbying Act.
But can you tell me one bill
so
that he's authored that's been signed into law.
That is a law. That is a law out there in congressional reform.
Let me jump in. Let me interrupt.
John McCain has 32 years in Washington, D.C., and let me just say this. While John McCain and his Republican allies are complaining about the media coverage, this is a guy who once said the media was his base, and any presidential candidate would give their left arm to receiving the kind of coverage that John McCain has received from the media over 10 years. Again,
now, let
this
me,
is all
I've
got to
break
great.
In. I've got to break in, Don. I've got to break in because our time is running short. That's all right. We like to have conversations like this, and we enjoy having the both of you on because we know that's what you're going to do. But I do want, in less than a minute, to get some sense from either of you who you think John McCain is going to select. We've heard the name Jindal from Louisiana. We've heard the name Pawlenty from Minnesota, the governor, because of that being a battleground state. In 30 seconds or so, John, do you have any sense of who he might pick and who the Democrats would want him to pick? I know. This was for Donna. I was asking Donna.
Sorry. Yeah. I thought you were asking Ryan.
No.
Look, first of all, I think it's all blue smoke and mirrors. I mean, John McCain is so desperate these days that he's using old recycled talking points from the Clinton primary fight with Obama. I don't think he's settled on anyone. I think there's a short list. I think Mitt Romney is likely on that list because he would bring a great deal of economic expertise that Mr. McCain won't have to outsource to others.
Well, let me ask Ryan to jump in really quick.
He has some other good choices in terms of governors.
Ryan, you've got less than 10 seconds. Who do you think?
Governor Mitt Romney would be the long shot. The dark horse would be former OMB Director and U.S. Trade Representative Rob Portman, who is very strong and from Ohio, economic and trade experience.
I appreciate both of you, Donna Brazile and Ron Christie, both joining us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C.
You need to bring a whistle next time.
I guess you're right about that.
Exactly.
Thank you both. Just ahead, you ever been called Cornelius as a black man when that's not your name? Coded racism creeps into the workplace, and it's a topic for our bloggers. Plus, polygamy. It's not limited to sect leaders like Warren Jeffs. We'll talk about polygamy in the black community next. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Barack Obama's fact-finding trip overseas dominates the news. While John McCain fights for the media spotlight, it's the hottest topic right now on our blog, News and Views. And here to tell us about it is Jeffrey Bennett. He is the web producer for News and Notes. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
So on yesterday's show, we focused on the substantial media coverage surrounding Barack Obama compared to that of his rival, John McCain. We did some more of that in the segment just before you came in here. What are folks saying about that online?
Well, people were actually talking about that as the conversation unfolded during yesterday's show. So here's a sampling. Moji Odorinde wrote in our blog, "Do I see a disparity? Yep. It's because Obama is the new thing, so the media follows the new sensation." And a reader named John Jay had this to say, "Obama is the reason he's coming off well on this overseas tour. The press is just witnessing it, not creating it. This is another one of those floaters that the media picks up on, because to them, everything is about them." And then that led to a back and forth about the political ideologies of the press corps.
All right, staying with politics for just a moment. Democrats will meet in Denver next month for their national convention, and the city has come under scrutiny for what it plans to do with the city's homeless during that gathering. Tell us about that.
Well, in addition to keeping the city's homeless shelters open for longer hours, the city's actually going to give or planning to give homeless people movie tickets and passes to the Denver Zoo and the local museums in an effort, some say, to keep them off the streets and out of sight. So we talked about that in our blog, and one reader named Jason called it, quote, "the hypocrisy of our democracy." And we took an unscientific poll of our readers asking, is Denver unfairly targeting homeless people? And 69% of those responding said, yes, they are.
All right. A couple of weeks ago, we here started doing something new. We started putting video of some of our radio interviews on our blog. What's been the response to that?
People have been really surprised and happy about it, frankly. We posted interviews with Dr. Dre's mom, Verna Griffin, Super Bowl champ David Tyree. We had red carpet coverage from the BET Awards, and we had an interview with R&B singer Shantae Moore. It was between you and Shantae. And she explained how one of her songs ended up going to an artist I think most people will recognize. So here's part of that interview.
J-Lo and I came out around the same time when her first album came out. And Rodney Jerkins actually came and wrote this wonderful song for me called If I Gave Love. And you know, the Jennifer Lopez song was If You Had My Love. He wrote the same song for her. I heard that it was because Puff Daddy walked in and said, and heard my song and said, I want that song. And he was like, yeah, well, that's already taken. You know, we wrote that for Shantae and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah, I want that song.
Yeah, so that whole clip can be found on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.
Really quickly, what are people talking about online this week?
Well, today we're taking questions for a conversation we're going to have on tomorrow's show about Obama's rise and the impact it is or isn't having on race relations in the country. So people should write to us on our blog, and we might use some of them on the air.
Appreciate it very much, Jeffrey. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. Join me here in our NPR studios. Thanks, bro. Now on to our bloggers' roundtable. The blogosphere is buzzing about coded racism. What is it, and why is it happening in the workplace? Plus, Disney rethinks its first black animated heroine amid accusations of racism. With us is Jay Anderson of Average Bro, freelance writer and nonprofit consultant Amy Larimore of the blog Alid's Work in Progress. She blogs with her husband at Political Season, and pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd. He also hosts Afro Nerd Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, everybody.
What's up?
Hello.
Listen, in the last decade, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has seen an influx of cases involving racially coded words. In one case, a black employee was repeatedly called Cornelius in a reference to the ape character from the movie Planet of the Apes. Another case involved a man of Chinese and Italian ancestry who was taunted daily by his foreman, who referred to him as Bruce Lee. Let me begin with you, Jay, and ask this question. Do you think that racism has migrated into this weird gotcha strategy where people use slurs and epithets either openly by claiming they're ironic or covertly by subbing an innocuous word for what they really wanted to say?
I think it absolutely has. And, you know, the examples that you brought up, you know, honestly, if somebody called me Cornelius, I wouldn't think Planet of the Apes. I'd probably think Don Cornelius.
So that's interesting.
I don't know if I would take that one as an ever, you know, I don't know, slur or what have you. But I do think, you know, if you look at a good example would just be this year's presidential election and the many things we've seen in terms of, you know, some of the covert messages with Obama winning South Carolina because he's just black. And then the whole terrorist fist jab thing with Fox News. And then the other thing with Fox News with the baby mama drama. I mean, it's one thing after the other. And I think, again, these sorts of instances, whether they're in the workplace or, you know, in the media, they do show that, indeed, I don't know, racism is maybe taking a different form now. It is indeed more covert. It's not as in your face, but it is still there. And I think these sorts of instances just show that is still the case.
Well, Amy, he raises an interesting point. We were talking about Cornelius, and he was not thinking Planet of the Apes, but thinking Don Cornelius. So that means, does it not, that it depends on your point of reference in terms of what people say to you and how you interpret it?
It surely does depend on your point of reference, but what we know is that when you're calling somebody by a name that's other than their given name, that it's not meant to be uplifting. And so when we're talking about the workforce and what's happening when you're on your job, you know, we live in the U.S., people are free to think whatever they want to think, but the fact that people have to be subjected to that in the workplace and that employers or peers think that that is okay has to be a notion that we take on and take on very vigorously.
Well, Desmond, have you ever been subject to coded racism or called something out of your name that you could repeat here?
Not to my knowledge. I have to be frank about that. But I guess my main concern with this issue is I'm more concerned with black folks being prepared for these kind of things. I'm not really shocked. I mean, on my blog, I'm more concerned with internal dysfunctionalism within our communities. And the racism thing, you know, that really gets many of our goats, I guess. It gets our blood boiling so we're able to make moves on these kind of issues. But at the end of the day, I'm not really shocked. I just would hope that, I mean, listen, the Dark Knight has just been released. And I say that to be facetious.
Yeah, that's interesting,
but,
yeah.
But when you look at what he's able to do, I mean, I am called the Afro Nerd, so. But when you see what he's able to do as a character and able to do things covertly, I think it's time for black folk to do the same thing in reverse. Take copious notes, take record keeping, have your witnesses ready to be prepared when something comes down down the pipeline that, you know, something like this may happen. So I'm not really shocked about it. Just be prepared for it.
Well, you know, one of the things that keeps coming up with regard to how black folks react to these kinds of coded and uncoded, sometimes not so subtle messages, is people think we have thin skin and we can't take a joke and we can't get beyond certain things that we should be able to get beyond at this stage. Jay, I'm interested in your reaction and response to that. Are we too sensitive? Are we hypersensitive to what people are saying to us now?
You know, sometimes we are, but, you know, even every joke has, I guess, some bit of truth to it. I'm probably paraphrasing that cliche the wrong way, but a good example of you know, whether you should take something wrong way or not. In my office a couple of weeks ago, we had an instance in which, after hours, a bunch of laptops were stolen. The next day at work, you know, the administrative assistant just happened to only ask the black males in the office, you know, how late they worked the night before. Now, I mean, you could take that as, you know, the office administrator inferring certain things about who might have stolen the laptops, even though it doesn't really make any sense. Or you could just look at it as her, you know, doing due diligence based on, I don't know, someone's eyewitness accounts of who was in the building at that amount at that time. I mean, again, do we have thin skin in some cases? Yes, but we wouldn't have thin skin if there weren't enough documented examples of things that actually do happen. I think, you know, the reality is black people to some degree, you know, walk in some level of paranoia every day. I mean, and a lot of that is learned behavior. A lot of it is, again, you know, things that could be perceived, you know, as being offensive or not.
One more question on this topic, and it's for you, Amy, before we move on. And it has to do with this, whether or not as a female you find that the coded words that you get are often sexist or gender-based as much as racially based.
Well, I think black women in particular, we get it dual-fold, but I think the point of it goes back to something that was said earlier about, you know, is it thin skin? I think what we have to really be prepared to do at any given level is just say, you know, people are not going to come at you correctly in many instances, and what is my response? How do I deal with it? What is the precedent that I set? Because I think sometimes it gets just way too much conversation and communication, when what we need to be doing is teaching a new generation to how to deal with this level of racism as it exists.
Teaching a new generation how to deal with racism, that's a perfect lead-in to my next topic, which is this. Disney is fending off accusations of racial stereotyping in its forthcoming animated film, The Princess and the Frog, an American fairy tale which features its first black princess. The original heroine was Maddie, a chambermaid for a cruel white debutante in the 1920s New Orleans. Maddie's fairy godmother reportedly was a voodoo priestess who would help her win the heart of a white prince after he rescued her from the clutches of a voodoo magician. Now, after word of that plot got out, Disney began making some changes, first to its title, The Frog Princess, which some interpreted as a slur. Also, the heroine has been recast as 19-year-old Tiana, and the race of the villain has also reportedly been revised. I don't know if you are parents or not, but I'm going to start with you, Jay, and here it is. Many are asking, why did it take Disney so long to make a story with a black prince? And now that it's here, people are complaining about the way that she's being depicted. What's your take on this?
Well, you know, I have a 2-year-old son, and I happen to agree. I mean, I would find this movie offensive. I mean, as parents, we are responsible for making sure that our kids are taking in images, you know, that are going to make sense to them. And in this case, you know, if you have a villain who happens to be black, if you have the knight in shining armor who happens to be white, you know, that's just too much going on, again, for a movie about a princess. And I think, again, the criticism of Disney is valid. I think what this does point out, though, is that unfortunately, when we as black people don't control our media, these sorts of things are bound to happen. I mean, a good example would be really for my 2-year-old son. The only thing that he can watch on television that really affirms him is Little Bill. You know, it's a cartoon that comes on Nickelodeon that happened to be put together by Bill Cosby. There's really no other equivalent, unfortunately. I mean, there's nothing else that affirms him as a 2-year-old black boy in terms of cartoons. And that's unfortunate, but again, it's a byproduct of the fact that we as black people do not control our own media enough, and movies would be one offshoot of that.
Are you finding, Desmond, that this is a big topic on the blogosphere these days?
Not as big as I would like it to be. I mean, I think I did mention this on my blog also, but my problems with this particular issue is that what would happen if we did control this particular issue or particular topic Sometimes we can be our own masters of stereotyping. We just go to BET or TV1.
That
would be true. And also, I mean, I had a problem with the fact that the name was changed from Maddie to Tiana, because I thought Maddie was a quality name, but because of the oversensitivity portion of this thing, Maddie sounded like Mammy, which is ridiculous to me. And it kind of goes back to the whole niggardly versus the N-word debate, or recently the black hole thing. So I think, to be blunt, sometimes African-Americans are confused. I mean, you know,
really?
In some respects. I mean, it's 1920s Louisiana, and it's got to be some degree of accuracy as to what that time period meant. So now we're making her Tiana in 1929. I don't know any Tiana's in 1929.
That's an interesting point. Amy, you have kids?
I do, and I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I have to say that I think we're just not looking at Disney for Disney. If you look at Pocahontas, Belle, Snow White, Jasmine, they all have issues. And so I think we need to spend less time talking about the first African-American princess and talk about what happens to get the next prince and three princesses down the road. My daughter's peers don't have to look to one princess to help her create her image. And I'm not looking to Disney, master of killing off mothers in their show, to affirm my daughter. I agree. When I think about the name and the sensitivity, Tiana doesn't relate to my daughter any more than Maddie did. And I think that when we try to influence the story, we lose some of the original aspects of the fact that they're going back to original art with a mother who's a graphic artist. I have a great interest in seeing them use original artwork and not just computer generated art. So I think there are aspects that we can look to, but we need to ask the question of ourselves, where are all the other princess stories? What are we doing?
Do you think that these films really do have an impact on your children? To what extent?
I do, because I see what happens with the mass media and the birthday parties and the costumes and the attire. You know, we're talking about just a $1 billion business of making little girls feel worthy and making them feel happy. And I don't have a problem with that. I just think we have to have more than one image and not rely on Disney to create the ideal.
It's an interesting point that all three of you made, and we have just enough time for one other topic that deals with image, and it's sort of on the other end, if you will, of what we are talking about. This involves Ebony Magazine, which is a black publication, choosing 8 of the coolest black men to grace the covers of their upcoming issues. Barack Obama, Jay-Z, Billy Dee Williams, just 3 of those who made the list. So is this sort of the flip of what we were just talking about very briefly, Jay, and is this a good thing to have cool black images like this selected by a magazine?
I think I'm honestly indifferent. I don't think it's anything that hurts or necessarily improves, the image of black men. I think if nothing else, it's good to hear Ebony being talked about again. I mean, they went through a revamping of the format of the magazine a few months ago, and it looks like they're maybe picking up some traction, you know, which is good. I mean, it's good. I mean, I'm used to Ebony just being that magazine you read when you're at your grandmother's house. You know, so to see them being relevant again, that's a good thing.
That doesn't bother you? What about you, Desmond, really quickly?
Well, just incidentally, I collect vintage Ebonies back from the 40s and the 50s, and it's interesting to see how they promoted their heroes. It was a different time back then, and I think that this particular, what they're doing now, it's a pretty good thing, but I've critiqued Ebony in the past, so I think for this particular situation, it's a pretty good one.
All right. We've been talking with Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro. He was at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd. He also hosts Afro Nerd Radio on Blog Talk Radio. He was at our New York studios. Plus, freelance writer and nonprofit consultant Amy Larimore of the blogs Alid's Work in Progress and Political Season. She was at member station WFYI in Indianapolis, Indiana. Now, you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org, and the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues that you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Yesterday, a grand jury indicted polygamous sect leader Warren Jeffs on felony sexual assault charges of a girl in Texas. The news once again put the spotlight on the practice of polygamy in the United States. In a few minutes, we'll talk to an anthropology professor who lived with polygamists in the Southwest as part of her doctoral research. But now, we hear from Deborah Mujeed, who studied how polygamy has played out in African-American Muslim communities. Mujeed is an associate professor and chair of philosophy and religious studies at Beloit College in Wisconsin. She explained to our Farai Today some of the different terms used to describe the practice of polygamy.
Polygamy, which is a popular term used as an umbrella for all plural marriage, actually refers to an individual who has more than one spouse, husband or wife. What's going on in Texas and what goes on in some Islamic countries among some Muslims is polygyny, and that is when a husband takes more than one wife.
You have studied American Muslims, black
yes.
American Muslims specifically, who have polygynous relationships.
Yes.
First of all, I would imagine it's somewhat difficult to get people to talk.
My initial motivation for this study, which started 5 years ago, and my ability to gain access had to do with the fact that a very close friend of mine had polygyny forced upon her.
How did the woman that you learned about get forced into a polygynous marriage?
She and her husband had been married about 15 years. One day he came home to tell her that, as she realizes, that the Quran permits a man under certain circumstances to be married to more than one wife. This was out of the blue for her. And for women like her, who are very committed Muslims, in that context, she felt that this was imposed upon her.
What about people who go into these relationships with full consent?
I think that was what was so surprising to me. I must admit, when I first started the research, I probably held presuppositions that many other people had. And that is, I thought these women were crazy. Well, I discovered that there are women for whom there are no available men, particularly Muslim men or African-American Muslim men, or however they want to perceive or what would be a good mate for them. Some women I have interviewed look for an opportunity to be a second wife because they want to continue their careers. They do not want the full-time responsibilities of a husband. And they are economically set, but they do want to experience the benefits of marriage. And in Islam, the family is the nucleus of Islamic society, and legitimate sexual intercourse can occur only within the bounds of marriage. So for some women, sharing a husband is preferred.
Let's turn to polygamy in the news. To your best estimation, how pervasive is abuse, particularly of girls and women, in a polygamous context?
I have found no evidence that there is there are pedophiles or incest or any type of abuse, sexual abuse of children in the communities and families that I have visited and studied. I'm pretty confident that if it happens among African American Muslims, it is rare.
What's the future of polygyny?
I think it has been with us for centuries, so this is nothing new. As this conversation evolves, we will begin to question how we construct definitions about marriage and family in general.
Well, Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Deborah Mujeed talking about polygyny in African-American Muslim communities. She's an associate professor and chair of philosophy and religious studies at Beloit College in Wisconsin. She spoke with us from the studios at Beloit. For more on polygamy in the United States, we turn to Kathleen Heath. She's an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana State University. Kathleen, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
You lived with some polygynous communities in southern Utah several years ago. Tell us a little bit about the gender dynamics between the men and women that you observed there.
The polygynist issue is amazingly varied. You will have some groups who live polygynously where the males and the females get along fine. It was female choice to participate in it. They may live in the same households. They may live in separate households. However, you also see this more disturbing picture of polygyny where it is very male-dominated. And in some severe cases where there's such isolation that, in fact, the females are severely brainwashed at an early age and really don't even recognize the fact that they have rights within a marriage or that they even have a voice with who they do marry.
Is there a difference between what you call brainwashing and abuse?
What one culture might say as, this is our norm, another culture would totally reject that idea. In some cultures, it's simply the case that it's not so much abuse as it really is their culture, and the females choose willingly to participate in it. Where from a typical American female point of view, it would be considered abuse.
We spoke previously with Deborah Majeed, who's an associate professor at Beloit College, and she specifically studies Black American Muslim families who are polygynous. She told us that in her research with the families she studied, she saw no signs of abuse. If you were to hazard a guess at what percentage of polygynous families may have an abuse pattern within them, what would you say?
With the small isolated group of fundamentalists in the Southwest United States, I'd probably put it pretty close to 40% or 50% that has some form of physical or mental abuse from a perspective of a traditional American woman. Within kind of the broader picture, I would suspect that the more it's underground, the worse the circumstances can be for the female because she has no outlet.
Give me a couple of examples of what would constitute abuse.
With the groups that I lived with and studied, you would see, for example, females choosing their male partners, maybe not to the extent that you and I would, but they would choose. You would see these relationships work out as well as they would in any kind of traditional monogamous American family. On the other hand, you would see abuse where 13-year-old girls were forced to get married when they turned 14, were forced to marry men who were 50 and 60, were forced to obey the senior wife. Although you couldn't pinpoint perhaps physical abuse, it certainly was a large amount of control there.
You also have taken a look at African immigrants practicing polygyny in the United States. What are some of the issues going on there?
Because it's illegal, they have a particular struggle in getting help or even seeking help. And because they come from a culture where males tend to control the public sphere, so tend to control documents, where the female may be a legal immigrant to this country, the husband will control the documents. And so any sense of her expressing unhappiness or discontent within the family could cause her a tremendous hardship.
Well, Kathleen, thank you for your perspective.
Well, thank you.
That was NPR's Farai Chidea speaking with Kathleen Heath. She is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana State University. Brothers Doug and Ryan Stewart are known to sports fans as the Two Live Stews. They began their broadcasting careers bringing the Black male perspective to sports talk radio. That concept has parlayed them into television. Only now, the brothers aren't limited to sports. They are charged with exploring the gamut when it comes to African-American men. The show was called Black Men Revealed, and the first episode aired on TV One last Sunday. Ryan and Doug Stewart joined me from the set of the show to talk about it. Here's Ryan.
The idea is basically to allow the world, all of the TV One viewers, which happens to be 43 or so million homes, to get an inside look at Black men's thoughts on several different issues, from our roots and how we were raised, from fatherhood, We have one show that's called Fantasies, which we talk about little secrets and stuff inside the bedroom. One show was called The Secrets Out, where we talk about the syndrome that I called the Down Low Brothers, where we had a few gay guys that were on the show with us. And it's very entertaining, somewhat comical, and it's very enlightening.
So, Doug, here's my question to you. Why do we need a show about what black men think and feel and want to talk about?
Well, you know what? I think the premise of it is to, like, open up to, in particular, I think, to black women. You know, you always hear women say, man, I don't understand why my guy or my man does this. I don't understand why he says this or he acts this way. So it's kind of like a round table, set up like a round table where me and Ryan host the show. There's an expert in the field, some type of a doctor, what have you. As well as we add a comedian, a well-known comedian most of the time, to keep it, you know, lighthearted. We talk about different issues, and really, truly, after you watch all 9 episodes, you're going to get a better understanding how brothers think and have a lot of fun doing it.
You know, I've seen the show, and it seems unscripted and at times completely on the fly, though, is it?
Well, it's not completely on the fly. What happened was the producers for the show, MacVision, they set some bullet points and different issues and different topics that we wanted to hit that we'd introduce, basically, me and Ryan. And once we introduced the point and the subject for that segment, it was a free fall. Guys basically, you know, gave their opinions, opened up their hearts. There was nothing scripted after that point. So pretty much, yeah, it was on the fly. Their real opinions. Honest opinions, and you know, it makes for a funny, entertaining show, to say the least.
Yeah, we had direction and we had an aim when we got started with each segment, but you know how brothers are when they get to talking and get to be familiar with the people that you're talking to and you get comfortable, things go all over the place. So, you know, it's definitely unscripted.
Well, Ryan, you talk about a lot of things, some very controversial on the show, but are there areas that are off limits that you just will not talk about?
Nothing's off limits. I mean, the show that we did where we had 3 gay guys on the panel as well as a comedian and Doug and I, that was a show that I thought was going to be uncomfortable at one point in time because it kind of got heated with thoughts and opinions. It's a show that no one should miss, but no, everything's fair game. People were not holding back at all. There were a couple of shows where shouting episodes took place between one or two of the guests or between Doug and I because of different things. Doug and I have our own thoughts with most issues anyway. So when I say it was a lightning rod, this season was a lightning rod, it definitely was.
Would you say, Doug, that this show, your show, Black Men Revealed, is it the view on testosterone?
Well, I won't say it's the view on testosterone, but what I will say is a good cross-section of some diverse brothers and some guys that can keep a good conversation and keep you entertained. In no way will we say these are the opinions of every black man in America. Obviously, we can't say that. But it is a good cross-section of the thoughts that brothers have and on some of the issues that brothers talk about in the barbershop and are somewhat controversial. You know, you got to have controversy if you're trying to do a TV show. People want to be, you know, entertained as well as they want to be kept and locked into exactly what you're getting into.
Well, you know what? On that very point, the show that I watched, it had the guy that had on the, I guess he wrote a book. He had on a white baseball cap turned backwards, green eyed. I can't think of what his name was. And another guy who was a college professor and Johnny Mack, I think was the guy's name from Richmond, who was on the show with you. And here's what you guys were talking about.
It goes all the way back to that movie, The Birth of a Nation.
Saw that.
When the Ku Klux Klan was chasing these wild-looking black men for trying to be with white women. Again, that comes from sexual envy. Because ultimately, their women see us as superior to them on certain levels.
And I say amen to them.
That's, hey, your grandmother said it all day long. Once you go black, you never go back.
Black male sexual prowess and how whites are jealous of black males and a lot of stuff along that line that sounded quite frankly to be racist.
But I mean, that's the type of thing that is talked about, to be quite frank with you. You know, brothers' prowess in the bedroom, whether they're handling their business or not. And we weren't afraid to talk about those things and hit those subjects as well. You know, there's a lot of times there's stereotypes, and part of the show, I think, was to debunk a lot of stereotypes, as well as, you know, get into the conversation on some of the things that were taboo. And so I think we handled that as well as you could, but at the same time, we still addressed the subject.
And Tony, way before Doug and I hosted the second season of Black Men Revealed, I heard at a very young age, once white women go black, they don't go back. So that's not something that was originated on the Black Men Revealed. That's just something talked about on Black Men Revealed.
And this is a show about men revealing themselves, so let's reveal something about black men. What do black men like to talk about?
Black men like to talk about women. Black men, we love to talk about sports. Having a good time. In my circle right now, we're talking a lot about golf. I call it the Tiger Woods factor. So many brothers I know are playing golf right now. It's incredible. It's like the number one thing for my demographic to do in Atlanta. So, I mean, a wide array of things, just normal guy talk. And I think that it changes a little bit. It fluctuates a little bit the older you get. You know, I'm talking a lot of politics right now.
Well, Ryan, you're the younger brother. What do you say black men like to talk about?
I'm right around the same lines as Doug. I recently got married, and when we did this show, I wasn't married. So my thought process when it comes to things that I'm talking about has changed a little bit because I'm a one-woman man now. So my thoughts are along the lines of Doug. I also, with the stuff that's going on in the political scene right now with John McCain and Obama and Jesse Jackson, you know, that's been a topic of discussion with my friends as they come over and have a beer and watch a game at the house. We found ourselves becoming somewhat political, even though I've somewhat always had a little political edge that I was interested in. We talk about sports because that's just what we do, and we hang out. And like Doug said, I mean, the average man talks about women throughout the course of the day somewhere. So those things are kind of the same as my brother.
All right. The show is Black Men Revealed. The host, Ryan Stewart, and his brother, Doug Stewart, on TV One. Thank you guys for coming in. Good luck with the program.
Tony, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony.